Good afternoon. So my plan is to take questions for exam review. I assume we have 75 minutes of questions about the material. If not, we don't. So I don't have anything in particular prepared. So what would you like me to talk about? Yes.
Could you go over the cache blocking question from the most recent post quiz?
Blocking on most recent post quiz. Okay. What do you mean by the cache blocking questions?
Like how many cache misses there will be?
Okay, cache misses questions. They aren't really cache blocking. Yeah. Locality questions on quiz. Okay. Bubbling and squashing. Okay. Yes. Q4, which is return and pipelines. Returns and pipeline hazards. Okay.
Can you go over the II in the loop? I'm not sure what that's called.
Cache blocking? What, anything more specific?
Just like what it means when you break it up into II and I.
Okay. II breaking up a loop. Okay. Yeah.
Could you go over a question when we're given certain numbers, like block size, number of sets, and you have to find all those?
Okay, so tag, index, offset, etc. Questions. Okay. Anything else that people can think of now? Yes.
I guess how does spot
like
good like temporal
locality? Okay, temporal. Anything else? So, has, okay.
Is out of order indexing, like the out of order processing, is that going to be able
to? If it's if we talk about out of order, it's going to be that it exists. Yeah.
Same thing with precise exceptions.
That will not precise exceptions. I'll just write it down, okay? I guess out of precise exceptions, out of order. Okay. Yeah.
Loop unrolling.
Okay. Anything in particular about loop unrolling? Nope. Okay.
Like number of stalls for examples of numbers of stalls for different instructions.
Finding numbers of stalls, okay. Yeah. Inlining. Anything in particular about it? Nope, okay. Yeah.
Aliasing.
Yeah, aliasing, okay. So everything we covered last week. And anything else? I have a full list, so let me try to sort this. So the locality stuff goes together. These probably go together. These go together. That we can deal with first. Okay. So precise exceptions and out-of-order processors. What we need to know about out-of-order execution is that's the thing which exists. Precise execution is a concept about how out-of-order processors work, which we probably won't talk about this semester, and if we do, we'll talk about it when we talk about exceptions in general after this exam. So it exists. Instructions out of order. I probably should expand that's out of order. That's what OO stands for. Precise exceptions covered later, if at all. Okay, so the cache misses questions on the most recent post quiz. So I believe I prepared. So if we pull up the code here, so what this code does is it accesses the array at index 0, 1024, 2048, and so on, 1001 times 2. And because it's an array of logs, those indices are 8 kilobytes apart in memory. So that's the most important thing. So the first question asks about a 64 kilobyte cache that's direct mapped. So that means that when we think about how things map to that cache, we take the first address, it goes to the first set. The second address goes to the second set, and so on, all the way up until we get to 64K of addresses. Then we wrap around. So the byte at address 64K goes to the first set again. The byte at 64K plus 1 goes, you know, to the next byte of the first set, and so on. And then we wrap around again at 128K, 2 times 64. And this, another way of thinking about it is that we take the bottom bits of the address corresponding to the binary parts, which would give us the remainder when we divide by 64K. And that's what we use to look up both the cache set and the offset in the block. That's all in those bottom parts of the address. And you could have done the computation of how many sets are there, how many set index bits are there, and so on to figure out how many bits that is. And you'd find out that that means when you increment the address by a power of 2, where all those bits are 0, which 64K would be, nothing changes. So this means that since these addresses are 8K apart, they only map to 8 distinct sets in this 64K cache. So there's only 8 places where we're actually putting values. Did I do that right? Did I actually answer this question wrong? Yep. Okay. Wow. The key is wrong, and I never noticed. So apparently, I can't do math. That's why everyone was confused in this question. Is any of the answer? So let's actually figure this out. So I gave the right comment there about what maps to the same cache set, but that doesn't actually make the answer what I thought it was. I think I fiddled with the indices when I was writing this question is what happened. Fiddle with the bounds. So we have, we access 1,024 things. That's right. So the answer is right. And I was thinking wrong. So we access 1,024 things, and every 8 of them, they only go to 8 sets. And for each of those 8 sets, we try to put 256 things there. Does that make sense? So let's draw our picture of this. And I probably, so we have, we're accessing array at 0, array at 1024, 2048, and so on. And in our cache, and we do this, and then we access it at 1024 times 8, 1024 times 9, and so on, all the way up to 1024 times 1024, which, if I read the loop, would make sense. So we go all the way up to eventually 1024 times 1023. And in our direct map cache, we have sets. So we have set 0, set 0, and we have all the way up to set, so 64K divided by 64 bytes, so 1024, I believe. And array 0 maps to set 0. Array 1024, yes. In
that thing you just drew an arrow from?
This is 1024 times 8. I can. This is 1020. 1 times 8, 1 times 9. 1024 times 8 times 9. That better? Okay. So 0 and 1024 times 8 in the both map to the same set because the bottom bits don't differ by those last bits corresponding to 64k. Yes.
What do those represent? Like, what is that going through?
So this is array at, so we have our array. This is the value at that address goes to what part of our 64k cache? So this is, we have a cache where we have data, and we store a bunch of tags, and a valid bit, and that's what I'm representing, how we store these parts of the array in the cache. Yes?
So where did you get 1024 times 8?
So why 1024 times 8? Did I also do that? Because it's a long, so so it's a, so 1024 times 8 times 8 is equal to 64k. That's where I got it. And we have this times 8 is because this is the size of a long. So these two values are 64k apart in memory. And because they're 64k apart, that means they share the bottom bits of their address, the bits we use to determine what set we go to. Because they're exactly that far apart. And this is generally true whenever we have anything in this array, which is, in this case, 8k elements apart. Because 8k elements is 64k. So those all map to the same cache set. Yes?
So it only fills the first 8 sets of all.
So you say it only fills the first 8 sets. It's not the first 8, but it's only 8 sets.
Okay.
So the second set is not set 1, but it's set 128, I believe. And then the next one is set 256, and so on. So it only fills a small number of sets because all these addresses are related. So we skip over, every time we skip 1024 entries in the array, we skip 128 sets in the cache, and then we wrap around. Yes?
Just a little confused. Are the values between 0 and 1024, are they being accessed at all?
No. And that was because of, so the question is, were the values between 0 and 1024 being accessed at all? No, that's because of what our loop does here, because we increment I by 1024. So because we do that, we aren't using any of the rest of the cache. And because, so we're only using these 8 sets of the cache, and we're trying to store definitely at least 2 values in them before we do another iteration of that innermost loop. So we access 1024, array 0, array 1024, 3, then array 1024 times 8, 1024 times 9, and so on. And then we try to do it all over again. But the second time we try to access array 0, it's not going to be there because we've more recently accessed something that goes to that cache set, and we can't store 2 things in that cache set. The next time we try to store something in array 1000, read something from array 1024, even though we've read it before, it's not going to be there because we've more recently accessed something else that belongs in that same cache set. So even though we might be able to fit part of this array in the cache if the addresses weren't so inconvenient, if we weren't going by this power of two that made us not use all our cache sets, we're going to end up missing every single time. By the time we get back around after accessing all these elements repeatedly, we're going to end up having the cache only have the things near the end of the array in the eight places we're actually using. Yeah? Sorry?
Where did you get set 128? Why is it supported like that? The set number is like, why does it go from 0 to 128?
So it doesn't go from 0 to 128, but we're not using set 1, set 2, and so on. So one way you can figure out this question is you can look at how many set index bits are there? Where are they in the address? And you can look at how much incrementing I by 1024 changes them. And if you look at that, you'll find out that if you have our address, if you have array 0 and array 1024, if you look at the address, you'll have some bits in the address. I don't know exactly how many change, but you'll see something like this, where this is the difference, so all these lower bits can't change. And those overlap in some way with the set index bits. And that's what's happening here. And when we keep doing that, we never change that part of the set index bit, so we're not using all the sets. Yes. How did I get the number 10,040? The inner loop goes 1,024 times, and the outer loop goes 10 times. So there's a total of 10,240 accesses overall, and I think every one of them is a miss. The initial ones are misses because we have never accessed them before, and the later ones are misses because we've accessed something that conflicts before. Yes? You're going to what?
Miss every single time. The ones without it 24 times on the inner loop, and then the outer loop once 10 times. And if you're missing, if your data cache misses 10,240, you miss every single time.
Yeah, so we're missing every single time. And we're missing every single time because by the time we get to the end of the array, we've gotten rid of the beginning of the array from the cache because we've accessed something else that goes to the same set. And that's the general principle you should look for in this. You should say, what elements of the array map to the same set? So in this case, it's array 0 and array 1024 map to the same set. And that's because they're 64K apart, and this is a direct map cache. The general rule is that if you look at the size of a way in the cache, two things which are separated by the size of a way are going to map to the same set. Because a way is basically how tall the cache is, if you remember our pictures like this. You can't see that. Okay. Remember our pictures like this? It's how tall the cache is. And so that's how many spots we have to put things, basically taking into account how wide the blocks are, the number of bytes in each way. So that's the principle which is how I got this number down here for the second part. So here we have a 1.5 meg cache, which is three way. So each way, one block of each set is a total of half a megabyte. And that means when we're thinking about how things go to sets, the first half megabyte goes, you can think of going, you know, the first part of that goes to the top set, then the next set, all the way down until we have a half megabyte of stuff, and then we need to go back to the beginning. Now we have three places to put things in each row now, so we get to do that three times before we fill up the cache. But we're going to have the same problem that we had originally with conflict misses. It's just going to take a lot longer. We're going to get to the same set more quickly than you might expect because there's less sets. So it turns out that we have six things we access before we get to the end, which all map to the same set. And with a least recently used policy, that means the first three things we accessed are going to go away from the cache. We're going to get rid of them because they're old. But because we go back to the beginning in our loop, that's precisely what we're going to access again. So again, every single thing is going to be a conflict miss. So even though we access array 0 twice, it's not going to remain in the cache because by the time we get back, we'll have accessed at least five other things that conflict with it. And you can use the same idea we had before of looking at where are the set index bits, how many sets, how many of them change, and you can figure out how many places are we at, how many sets are we actually using in this cache. And then you say, how much stuff do I need to actually keep in this cache for everything to be in the cache at the end of the loop, and you'll find out that only the end of the array is in the cache at the end of the loop. So how do people feel about this question? Good, really, middling, thumbs down, okay. So let's try to do a simpler example. So let's say I do something like zero. I needed something to access. So let's say I do a loop where I access address 0. Address 10, address 20, address 30, and so on, all the way up to.
We don't see what you're writing.
Oh, yep, okay. That is. Okay, up to that. And I have a 32 byte direct map cache with 2 byte blocks. Let's start with this. So I access this list of indices. So first of all, what C code that might do this look like? Okay, I do this, and then I repeat. 0, 0, all the way up to. What C code that might do that? How would that look? So I'm accessing address 0, address 10, address 20, all the way up to F0, then address 0, address 10, address 20, all the way up to F0. What would a C function that does that look like? So a for loop, what's going to be in my for loop? So I equals 0 to what? 16 probably. And I need to access some array. And it matters what type the array has. So let's say it's an array of ints. So what indices would I be accessing it at?
Ints are 4 bytes.
Yes, assuming ints are 4 bytes. What indices would that mean I'm accessing it at if this is the pattern I have?
4i.
So 4 times i, how did you get that?
You want to do every 16 addresses.
Yeah, so every 16 addresses, 16 bytes is 4 ints. So I'd be going an increment of 4 times i. I could do it by multiplying I times 4 there. I could do it by incrementing I by 4. It would be accessing the same places. And you're doing something to that. And I'd also want to do this multiple times. So we could just repeat the for loop. I probably should write it out. Array 4 times i plus equals 1. So this is C code that might do that. So you have to look at how big is the array element so you can see what the addresses might look like. Now, I don't have any reason to think array would be at address 0. That would actually be pretty unlikely, but you'll see the same sort of pattern and the same types of conflict misses, most likely. So the next part is I gave you an assumption about my cache here. And the question is, how does this cache split up addresses? So how is it going to interpret each of those addresses? So how many block offset bits do we have? 1. So we have 1 block offset bit. And how many set index bits do we have? Or how many sets do we have? Why don't we start with that? 16 sets, which means we need to have enough set index bits to refer to all those 16 sets. So is it 16? Yes. So we have 4 sets, or 4 set index bits. So this means that the bottom 5 bits of the address indicate the set plus block offset. So the bottom 5 bits of the address tell you exactly what the candidate locations for that particular byte are in the cache. And because it's a direct map cache, there's exactly 1 of them. So what are the bottom bits for these addresses going to look like? Or to put it another way, so here, the bottom 5 bits are 0. I should use a different color. So here, the bottom 4 bits are 0. Here, the bottom 4 bits are 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, 0. Here, they're 0, 0, 0, 0, 0. Here, they're 1, 0, 0, 0, 0. And that pattern's going to repeat. And why is that happening? Because these 2 values are 32 bytes apart, which is the size of a way of this cache. So that means that those 2 values map to the same set. So every other value maps to the same set. So every other access, we're evicting the thing we accessed 2 times before. Every access we're evicting the thing we accessed 2 times before. Every other access goes to the set with index 0. And every other access other than that goes to the set with index 8. So we're only using 2 sets. So this is sort of a micro version of what was happening, except I had 1,024 sets before. Yeah?
Why are those 32?
Why are those 32 bytes apart?
Yeah.
So 0x20 is 32 bytes, is 32. And these are byte addresses. So it's just the numerical difference. And you can tell that 32 is the significant number because it's 2 to the 5th, which is the number of bits we have to determine where, what set we actually care about, the bottom of the address. So when I look at problems like this, the general pattern I want to use is I want to say, how many bits of the address actually matter for what set we go to? So I want to figure out this 5 number and say, how many different distinct, how many times are we using having the same values for those bits, or how many different ones do we have? You can think of it both ways. I think it's probably usually easier to say, when do we access the same set? So when are those bits the same? Which is generally, if we go to the same set every 32 bytes, when are we accessing two addresses which are 32 bytes apart? Yes. Yes, it would. So the question is, an int is 4 bytes, wouldn't it have to access 2 blocks? Yes, it would. So we actually have some extra catch misses here. I think usually I will try to remember not to give problems where that happens, mostly because we haven't talked about something called alignment, which is related to the issue of what happens if a value is in 2 cache blocks. Yeah?
Can you just explain why the address 10 is 16 bytes after 00.
So 10 is 16 in decimal. This is hexadecimal address. That makes sense? I didn't say, I just assumed OX would make people think definitely hexadecimal. But those are hexadecimal addresses, which is what I use because I went to see powers of 2. Other questions? Yeah. For why are the bottom 5 bits?
For address 0x10, why is it 0.00?
So this is the ones place. So we have the ones place, the 2s, 4s, 8s, and 16s place. So 10000, it's exactly 16. In binary, it's exactly 16. And 10 in hexadecimal is exactly 16, because we have the 1s place and the 16s place. And a general rule for converting hexadecimal to binary is you can do it a hexadecimal digit at a time. So for example, to convert 30 to binary, I can convert 3 to binary, 0011. And then I convert 0 to binary, 0000. And that's 0 hex 30 in binary, if I put those two things together. And that works in general. So how do people feel about, yeah. So this looping around, yes. So the question is, does the looping around happen even in an associative cache once you reach the size? Yes. So, but the size that matters is the size of a way, not the size of the cache. So if this were a, so if we think about a, if we had, say, a 32-byte two-way cache with 2-byte blocks, we'd have 1 block offset bit and 8 sets for 3 set index bits. So only the bottom 4 bits would matter. And that's because each way is 2 to the 4 bytes. That's 16 bytes. Because each of the two ways is 16 bytes, and that's when we wrap around, when we exhaust a way of the cache.
So every 16 bytes.
Yeah. And if it was 4 way, every 8 bytes, and so on. Yes?
So are all of these misses?
So yes, all of these would be misses. And as pointed out, actually misses to two blocks because we're accessing 4 bytes. Yeah.
So on this exam, you'll only ask questions where a block is big enough to hold an array access?
Yeah, we will. Yeah, we will be very clear if we're not doing that. And generally only where, we will only ask questions where array access will access a single block, because we haven't talked about how it would work otherwise. This is actually a problem in real processors, but we haven't actually talked about it. Okay, have people feeling okay on this sort of cache access question? Little, yeah.
So the loop goes through like array sub 0, array sub 4, array sub 8.
Yes.
Why are all of those stored in the same place? Why isn't it an array sub 0, array sub 32 are stored in the same place?
So array sub 0 and array sub 32 are stored in the same place, but also array sub 0 and array sub 4 are, because they're 16 bytes apart. So what matters is, because they're not 16, array sub 0 and array sub 4, array sub 8 are stored in the same place, because they're 32 bytes apart. Every other is stored in the same place in this case, because of how the numbers work out. Yeah. What? But every iteration is going to be a miss, because the question isn't, did we get rid of this the last time? The question is, did we access anything that got rid of it? And if you look at here, when we access array 0, you need to look back here. Did we access something which conflicted? And you'll say, oh yes, we did. We accessed array of 14. Therefore, array of 0 can't be in the cache. So because array of 14 and array of 0 are stored in the same place in the cache. So the question isn't, did we just get rid of it? The question is, did we access something in between that got rid of it? Right? Because there's lots of things that could have gotten rid of it. We have a whole, in this case, 15 accesses, which we have to look at each one and say, could this have gotten rid of array of 0 from the cache? And if any of them could have, that's a problem. Yeah?
Wait,
sorry,
when did you access array 14?
Sorry. 14 times 4. Your question, when would you access array 14? And of course, you would. 14 times 4 is what I meant. Sorry. That, obviously, that's why that didn't make sense. I was thinking of what the I value was, not array index. Yes?
How many data access misses are there?
In this case,
yeah.
Every single of the accesses is a miss. If you count accessing just each array access, so all of this case, 32 of the array accesses are misses, assuming the cache starts empty. So if we had changed this cache to, for example, be a fully associative cache, then the answer would not be different. If we had changed this to be a large enough cache, the answer would be different. So if we had made this into like a 1,024 byte cache, then the answer would be different. Yeah.
Would you ask us about a case where, like on the quiz, there were like those convoluted like 1,000 times or 1,024 times like 1,024 minus 512 times 9 or something like that? Like a case where that would actually be true?
We might.
In what case would that be true? Like what kind of like loop access or something like that?
So the question is, what case would you have them not all be misses? So one example is, let's say I access 0x01020. We had this example on a prior quiz. So for if I access these indices over and over again, I guess I can give. Yeah. if I access these indices and I ask how many misses for doing this pattern over and over again, we had this example before, then you know that one of the axes we have conflicts. The other one stays in the cache. And we can have this expand a bit more. So with the same idea, we could access 08, 018, 020, 28, 00, 08, 018. I don't think. Well, we could do like that. Oh, right. I'm doing a silly example. But 0. So we could do something like this repeated. 08, 010, and so on. In which case, we have this conflicts, but the others don't. Because we don't have any pairs of things that are 32 bytes apart. And that could change the number of things that are 32 bytes apart arbitrarily by going to 028. In that case, 010 and 018, 10 and 18 don't have anything they pair with that makes a conflict, and it would not be a miss. So that's the sort of patterns you have which would have caused that. Not everything to be misses, where some of the things don't conflict. And a classic example is where the array is slightly bigger than it should be to map nicely to sets, but not hugely bigger, like the examples on the quiz. Okay. So do people have more questions about these types of caching questions, or should I move on to other topics? Who thinks I should move on to something else? OK, so we'll do that. So go here. Next on my list of topics is tag index offset questions. So the general, one way to do this is to memorize the formulas. We're not going to give them to you. Another way is to remember the sort of picture of the cache, rows as sets, columns as ways, width of columns is block size. And so that gives you sort of a picture of how big the cache is. You can think of it geometrically. You have columns, which are block size widths, and you have ways numbers of them, and you have rows times them, and you can think of that, what that means geometrically as far as how to make the formulas that way. That's sort of how I memorize them. And as far as index bits are log base 2 number of things indexed. Or bits is log base 2 of number of things indexed in general. So the number of sets, if you take the log base 2 of that, that's the number of set index bits. The number of bytes in a block, if you take the log base 2 of that, that's the number of block offset bits. And tag bits, you just need to memorize as whatever is left over. And the usual procedure is you can do algebra on the formula. Like, if you don't know how you compute something, write down what you know and try to do algebra. Yeah?
There's a question on old exam that said you didn't need the block size to compute the tag. How would you do that?
So if you have other, so I believe on the old exam, so example, computing block size, you didn't need the block size to
compute the tag.
Computing tag without block size. So the tag is without block size given directly. So you could, so I believe this was a case where, right, without block size. You literally didn't need the block size. So the tag bits equals, the address size minus set index bits plus block offset bits. And I believe the thing in this question is if you did the algebra you found out that what you knew let you say that tag bits equals address size minus log base 2 of cache size divided by number of ways. And you can do algebra to figure out why that's the case. Sort of the intuition is that this is equal to the address size minus log base 2 of the number of sets times the number of the block size. And that's equal to log base 2 of the cache size divided by the number of ways, just because of what the cache size means. The cache size is the number of blocks, number of blocks you have times the size of each block. So you could figure it out, and the way I'd expect you to figure that sort of thing out on an exam if we asked it was to do algebra, and you'd get this sort of formula. You'd say, how can I solve these things? I have all this information I know. I have these formulas I know about how they relate. How do I solve them for tag bits? Can I solve them for tag bits? So just like leave the, you could like leave the block size as a form, as a variable, and see if it cancels out, which it should if it's not possible. Yes.
If you give us a
so the question is, if we give you a C snippet, would I tell you the how long the address size is? If it's relevant, usually it isn't. So like in the examples I've given, all you need to know is that whether that the array starts at the on a particular cache, at the beginning of a cache block. As long as that's the case, everything works always the same, because it just matters, are two things the correct distance between each other?
So in that case, you wouldn't ask us about the tag bits?
So if I didn't give you the address size, I wouldn't ask you how many tag bits there are. And you didn't need to know it to answer most of those sorts of questions. If we asked you about tag bits, I'd have to tell you the address size. Anything else about tag index offsets? Okay, so let's talk about bubbling and squashing. So there's two parts of this. One part is how do you set the bubble stall signals? And the general rule, which we went through in class, some examples, is figure out what instructions should be running next, and bubble signal if next instruction there should be instruction after reg should be a nop, and stall signal if next instruction the reg should be same as current. So that's the rule for what are the bubble install signals, given that I know what the processor needs to do in the next cycle, what instructions need to be running and fetch, decode, and execute and so on. So if in the next cycle and execute, I need to have a nop there, a pipeline bubble. I set the bubble signal on the registers before execute to true. If in the next cycle and execute, I need to have the same thing that's there now, I set the stall signal to true. If the next cycle, I need to have the instruction that was before go through, I leave it as normal. So the other part of this is when do I need to bubble stall and so on. So for branch predictions, the rule is we compute the result of the branch in that cycle. We set bubble signals. So in the next cycle, there are nops before, nops replacing every instruction that came after a mispredicted branch. So in pipe, this is in decode and execute. Instruction going to decode and instruction going to execute.
in a different, if we figured out the result of the branch in a different place, it would be different instructions. But the rule is we, in the cycle, we figure out the result of the branch. That's when we set these bubble signals to remove those two instructions. And this is squashing. In the next cycle, we fetch the correct instruction. So one way of thinking about it is that you can take the strategy we have above for figuring out what the bubble install signals are. Once you know what the instructions should be, and what the instructions should be is when we fetch the correct next instruction from a misprediction, we get rid of everything else in the pipeline. So every instruction that wasn't mispredicted goes through, and the instructions that weren't are replaced with nums. So you just say, given that, what's in decode, what's in execute, what's in memory, and so on. And once you figure that out, you'll know what the signal should be by following this procedure. Yes?
Just to clarify, like, to bubble, you, like, is, like, basically, like, insert, like, the knob, and you do squashing, you squash the instruction by bubble.
So we squash the instruction by setting the bubble signal, yes, like you propose. And that inserts a knob in place of whatever was going to happen previously. Yes?
So with like return, is that, I'm kind of confused how stalling is used with return.
Okay, so stalling with return, so finding number of stalls. So the general rule is forwarding requires us to, forwarding requirements must be computed before it's needed. Don't make any clock cycles much longer. Memory in. So we have these requirements in general for forwarding. So example with ret. Ret, compute the return address at the end of memory, near the end of memory. Stalling is adjust instructions so forwarding, etc. works, is what we generally do when we're stalling. So for return, stall fetch until return address computed, which implies stall fetch until ret's write back. That's because we need the value from memory, so we need to stall until that happens. With data dependencies, so we have our example of a stall in our processor. So for example, if I do pop q rax and add q rax rax, I need a stall. And that's because pop q rax is going to do fetch, decode, execute memory, write back. And add QREX, we want it to do here. You want it to do fetch, decode, execute memory, write back, but it can't. Do that. Because this means that we're reading a value from memory. And we're going to get the value near the end of the memory step, and we already are supposed to have computed on the value. So instead, we're going to end up doing our add where we're going to wait to execute memory until execute step until after we have the value from memory. So we have one cycle of stall. Yes?
Is that only because that's a hop?
That's because it accesses memory. Because we're accessing the value that comes from memory. So there's other instructions which do that, like MR move Q. But yes, but it wouldn't happen with an instruction which computes in an execute because that's early enough. Then I wouldn't have this star here. Yes?
So stall keeps the same values in the register like stall, right?
Yes.
So wouldn't that value still be passed over to the register afterwards?
So the question is, when we're stalling, wouldn't we, if you just stall a register, wouldn't it still be passed on later? Yes. This means that when you're doing what we call stalling, you're going to set the bubble signal. Because this property is going to be true, that some stage is going to need to run a knot. So in this case, when we're stalling, right here, we have a knot in execute. And that would have had to have been gotten there by someone setting the bubble signal. Yes?
So like, I noticed on the 2017 exam, there was a question about like how should forwarding work, and it was saying forward this from execute to this, or forward this from memory to this, and I just wasn't sure, like, because I figured my impression was that you could only forward something like after it passed through memory. But like based on the way the question was asked, like I'm not.
So we very commonly forward from before memory. So we have to forward, though, when the value exists. So we can't forward REX earlier than memory because we don't know what its value is supposed to have. But if we have, you know, some more innocent instruction that we want to forward from, then we can forward earlier. Here, we can forward from the end of execute. And that's no problem. Because we already know that REX is going to be 10 then. We have 10.
Right, but if the first instruction was like an add, then like you could do it from execute because it's not being stored.
So the first instruction is an add. We can also do it from execute because at the end of execute, it's fine. If we wanted it near the beginning of the execute step, we'd have a problem. But as long as we went near the end of the execute step, it's fine. And that's, for example, what you're supposed to do in your pipeline processor, is you take a value from the end of execute and put it in the pipeline registers for the code.
Right, because you just need it before the next execute.
Yes. Okay, so another note is stalling without forwarding. So if we didn't forward, in the case of this pop Q add Q RAX, we need to do a lot more stalling. So with forwarding, we just needed to have the value exist and we'd shortcut it. If we don't do that, then the value is not going to be right until after writeback happens. So we'll do something like that. That the end of writeback is going to write the value, and if we don't have any forwarding paths, and we need it to resolve the hazard with stalling, that's what we do. We just wait a lot longer because we don't have this shortcut. We need to wait until the writeback happens. Yes?
Can you execute after the fourth?
So the question is, could I put move the execute earlier? And the answer is no, because if you remember how a register file works, it writes at the end of the clock, at the rising edge of the clock, after we've set up all the values. Yes? So this is if you're with forwarding. So this is no stalling with forwarding. Yeah, so that would be, if we had forwarding, we also would need to stall in this case. If we didn't have forwarding, we'd also need to stall. The exact same amount, it turns out. Yeah. So how many stalls are there? So normally, we go directly from decode to execute. Now we add 3 extra cycles in decode, so there's 3 cycles of stalling.
Wait, so, in the with stalling, do you mind scrolling up for the last
time? Yeah.
Yeah, so with forwarding, that execute value is like computed and decode gets that value in the same, within the same cycle.
Yes, and that's okay to do because decode isn't doing anything with the value other than just putting it in the pipeline register. So it's not making our clock cycle significantly longer to do that. But I wouldn't want to, for example, compute a value and execute and then send it like to the memory in the same cycle. That would make my clock cycle a lot longer. Yes?
So with node stalling with forwarding, there would be a hazard?
There is a hazard.
There is a hazard because it doesn't go back to the code stage in time.
Yeah, so one way of thinking for data hazards, if we didn't do any forwarding, would we be in trouble? And the answer here is yes. Didn't forwarding or stalling. Okay, I think this addresses probably the returns and pipeline hazards, though there's a note, I'm not sure what that question is, and I would like to get to other topics. But I note that return reads RSP. Also, and we talked about also and wait until memory to finishes to fetch next instruction. Okay, so good temporal and spatial locality. And this is probably about the quiz questions on the post quiz. So up here, so the general rule for temporal locality is, first of all, are values accessed twice? If they aren't, there's no temporal locality. And that means for this first two loops, all the elements of A are not accessed twice. We never actually access an element of A twice. So there is no temporal locality in A for the first two loops. And then the third one, we do access elements of A twice. Not in a good, for a good reason, because I wrote the question in an unintended way. But we definitely access elements more than once, so there is temporal locality. But in the other cases, because each of those I times n plus j is going to be a unique value, we only access every element of A exactly once. So there's no temporal locality. Yeah?
Maybe I'm just missing something, but like for version 3, like, can you explain like how it accesses? Twice.
So in this outermost loop, during two consecutive iterations, we're going to have I equals 0 twice here, and j equals 0 twice. So the first time we go through this loop, I equals 0 and j equals 0. And the second time, when I equals 1, then I equals 0, which is not what I intended to write, but is what's on the page and unambiguous. So we access I equals 0, I times 0 plus j, which is 0. So we access some elements more than once. We don't access the whole thing more than once, but there's some parts of A we access more than once.
So if you access if I is like the same thing, like if I is like 0 twice but j is different, like does that count?
Only if the array element happened to be exactly the same. Which it wouldn't. But that's the first thing you look for temporal locality. Do we actually access things twice? If you don't, there's no temporal locality. If you do, the question is how frequently. And if one does it more frequently than the other, it would be the case. So as for spatial locality, the question is how far apart are the things we access each time we access them? So for example, in this loop here, when I access an element of B in one iteration, in the next iteration, I'm accessing one that's n away from it. Because there's B, j is what changes, and j is multiplied times n. And here, when I access an element of B, in the next iteration, I access one which is one away from it. Because I is what changes, so the index changes by one. So this has better spatial locality. In B. And worse in A for the converse reason.
So spatial locality is about the distances between axes to the same overall thing. Okay, so temporal, is it accessed twice? If so, how frequently are accesses? Spatial is it, what is the, yes. And so, I BJ J. I guess I won't try to put examples there. So, you know, so I'm going to try to like briefly touch on these before the end of class. So cache blocking, the splitting up a loop. So the pattern with cache blocking is that when we have a loop like, precisely the example we had there, where ai times n plus j equals b, bj times n plus I, this is going to have bad spatial locality in this case, and bad locality in A. This is bad locality in A, and good in, or bad locality in B and good in A. And if we swap the loop orders, we have good locality in B and bad in A. And we'll have this general pattern and, you know, common problem with loop orders is that we have sort of So cache blocking is going to give us, we're going to split up, we're going to say, instead of going I equals that, we're going to split up the I's, we're going to go like, have an I increment by 2, okay, say 2, and then we're going to choose our actual I, this time writing this code. Do that. Now we have better locality in B because we are the distance between consecutive B's, the axes, is often 1. So you have better locality in B. It's not perfect because often the distance is n, 2, but half the time it's 1. And we have worse locality in A. Sometimes N. But overall better locality and expansions, better choice than. For J's. So, yeah.
So does the first loop have better, or the first like code blocks that have better locality for A when compared to the second?
The first one? The first one has better locality compared to the second, but it's pretty marginal.
Okay.
But it is better because we have, you know, we're accessing two very far parts of A. Instead of just one very one part. So it is a bit worse. And sort of the key cache blocking idea is worse locality doesn't matter as long actually what question is what fits in cache. So as long as both of those two things which are far apart in A fit in cache, we're going to probably get some benefit because we're fitting more of the stuff from B in cache to, even though we had like more perfect accesses to A before.
And I've shown this for spatial locality. It also applies. The same sort of thing will happen with temporal locality. It just doesn't happen here because everything is accessed exactly once in this simplest possible example. So loop unrolling. This is the transformation from for I equals 0 this to foo of I to I that's what loop unrolling is. It's that transformation and saves, executes less instructions per loop iteration except to handle the leftover. So except for the little details about the few extra, about handling like the odd iteration in the case where we're doing two, it executes less instructions and therefore is often faster, but makes the code bigger, maybe more cache misses. So inlining is if we have this and a function transforming this to that's inlining. Yes.
On loop unrolling, why is it executing less instructions if you're doing more instructions?
So why is it executing I don't mean per iteration of original loop. So per element, basically. Per index is probably what I should say.
Okay.
So the save, yeah.
It does more instructions
per. Per iteration of the original loop. Per index is a better way of putting it. So inlining is we just take a function, just drop it in our, wherever we're using it. It's most useful in loops, which is why I'm giving an example in a loop. And this has the same sorts of trade-offs. So this makes code bigger, but less instructions for a function call return. So aliasing is two things are different names for the same thing. So an example was if I have a pointer, if I have a function foo that takes and I do this, the compiler can't reorder those because what if I could call foo at x at x? That could be a call of that, and the compiler needs to plan for that, even if a typical call would be this. And we had an example of this in lecture, which is more realistic, where even in more innocent cases where we had a result array and an array we were summing, the compiler doesn't know that they're not actually pointers to the same thing, even though that doesn't make sense to do. Yeah. So the question is if this only happened with pointers. So in C, we don't have any other ways of having two names for the same things unless one of them is a pointer. It could be the case that we have aliasing between a global variable and a pointer. So if I have a function foo which accesses a global thing and has a pointer, the compiler doesn't know that I didn't get a pointer through that global variable. But one of them has to be a pointer because that's the only form of indirection we have in C that works in this way. In other languages, that might not be the case. So if you have a language with references might be able to do this. so it's 1:45. Hopefully this was helpful. I will obviously post all the notes. Good luck on the homework. Tomorrow is exam review in lab, so I don't know if you want your exams or ask questions about finishing your homework late.
That was pretty stressful.